Attention, everyone. This is an emergency broadcast. The unpleasant noise you are about to hear coming from your radio is not a mistake. Please do not turn off your radio, but turn up the volume on your receiver as high as it can go so that you can make the sound we broadcast as loud as possible.
The monsters will now start attacking Tokyo.
Your eyes tell you it's true.
Shut. I'll turn up the sound so you can hear the monsters dueling to the death.
And welcome to episode 116 of the Kaiju Cast, a bi-monthly podcast 100% dedicated to Godzilla and all of his rubber-suited foes. My name is Kyle, and it's a very special episode that we recorded with the screenwriter of the brand new Godzilla film, Max Borenstein. But before we get into that, I have to tell you that this is a media blitz that I'm running right now on the Kaiju Cast. I'm going to be doing an episode every single week of the Kickstarter campaign that is running right now. Let me tell you about it. I want to fly to Japan, go to this really awesome Godzilla exhibition that's happening in Tokyo for only 2 weeks, and this is at the beginning of August. And this Kickstarter campaign is going to help me do that, and not only just go to see it, but the best part is we're raising the money specifically to make an independent documentary called Hail to the King, 60 Years of Destruction, and it's basically going to be about Godzilla's history. We're going to film the event, film around Tokyo, and hopefully we'll get a chance to interview people who were on the films, working in the background, and get their thoughts on Godzilla. It should be really awesome. Right now, we are halfway to our goal. We have 16 days left at the time of this recording, and really need your help to get it funded. We have some amazing perks from some amazing people. Matt Frank has donated his talents. Jeff Zorno has donated his talents. We have just a ton of great stuff. So there are fantastic backing levels for just about any dollar amount. Please check it out. Go to hailtothekingdoc.com. Doc is short for documentary. And fund our project. Send us there, because this cannot happen without your help. Let's get to the meat of things here. In addition to the screenwriter of Godzilla being on the podcast, we have another guest. And actually, he's not here in the studio right now. Lady Kyle is here.
Hello, everybody.
And she actually is friends with this guy. His name is Thomas. And Thomas hooked me up with the interview and then demanded to be on the episode. Just kidding. He asked if he could, and I said, yeah, no problem, dude. So no one has ever met Thomas before through the podcast. So Lady Kyle, would you please do me a favor and tell the listeners a little tiny bit about Thomas?
Well, I just call him Tom. But he is longtime friends with a friend of mine. And we met recently, a couple months ago, I think, not that long ago. When we started talking about photography, and he had moved up here from San Diego not that long ago. So he was like, he sent me a message on Facebook, said, hey, I'm interested in photography. We started talking, and then realized we had a not so awesome connection, but a connection, in that he had recently been in a car accident, and I got in a nasty car accident a couple years ago. So it was a good overlap of me being able to kind of share my experiences with my stuff going through the car accident, and kind of be there for him and be supportive. So we formed a quick friendship, and then he met man Kyle and knew about his love of kaiju and all things like that. And so he was like, oh, I know this dude. And I was like, oh, what dude? And so they started talking and then figured this whole thing out. So it worked out pretty well for everybody.
Yeah, it was, it was very serendipitous, and I like how it happened really quickly too. Like, he was like, hey, do you want to do this? And I was like, that would be great. And then all of a sudden we were having like a conversation with Max Borenstein on social media platforms.
Yeah.
Anyway, that is all beside the point. We are going to play one small short track from the Godzilla soundtrack, and then we're going to get right into the interview with Max Borenstein. This is Following Godzilla.
Thank you.
joining us through the internet and our good connection here with Tom is Mr. Max Borenstein, the screenwriter for Godzilla. Max, thank you so much for being on the podcast.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So I've actually wanted to talk to a screenwriter for quite some time because I really am interested in the screenwriting process. But what I'd love to start out with is how you got involved. What made you want to be a writer and write creatively?
Storytelling. I mean, I it's hard to like dig back, I guess, to psychological roots, but I've always, there's been nothing I've ever loved. I love stories in general and movies in particular. But from a very young age, that was always my favorite stuff, to make things up and make stories up. And whether it was like sitting around with my friends playing G.I. Joes and then, you know, and then watching movies and kind of recreating the same scenarios improvisationally with my friends with our G.I. Joe figures. And then I became obsessed with movies and knew that I wanted to tell stories that way.
You started working in Hollywood really early, right? I think I heard on a different podcast that you started at the age of 13, right?
Yeah, so what happened was my mom sold medical insurance and had a list of names, as you do in that field, and had called someone and found out just because she had chatted with the person that they were that they worked at a production company that Oliver Stone ran. And so my mom knew that I wanted to do movie stuff. So she gave me the phone number and I called them. This is the summer of my ninth grade year, and asked if they were interested if I had room for an intern. So they said, sure, come on in. And they didn't know anything about me, including how old I was. So I was driven by my parents who sat in the lobby as I went in for this interview, and got the job. Ostensibly, I filled out a form, and they were impressed with, like, I don't know what they thought, but I guess they said, it's going to suck, you're going to pour coffee and Xerox things. But I was eager to do that, and so they gave me the job. But by the time I got home, they had read my application and seen that I was child labor laws prevented me from working there. And so I got very disappointed, I was very disappointed to find an answering machine message to that effect. But the guy who I'd interviewed with took pity on me and invited me back. And then he ended up giving me some screenplays, and that was the first time I'd ever really seen a screenplay. And they weren't, this is kind of like pre-internet giving you everything you want all the time. So I really didn't know what that was. You know, I knew there was a screenwriter, there was a writer, but I didn't know what format it took or what it looked like or how it worked. So he gave me some scripts and said, read these and come, we can talk about them. And then that led to like a kind of monthly sort of mentorship. And I started writing my own stuff, and it became way better than a real internship would ever have been.
I would say so. Wow. So what would your 13-year-old self think of your current situation where you're actively writing scripts?
I've been thrilled. I mean, I've been pretty single-minded since then, in the sense of, I mean, I always wanted to write and to direct, and I've been, ever since that moment, I was very single-mindedly focused and obsessed about the idea of doing it. And so the fact that I get to do it professionally, and that now there's been a real movie out with my name on it, would, I think, thrill the old me.
And an awesome movie, too. So I was wondering if you could maybe do me a big favor, and I'm thinking the listeners a big favor, and sort of explain what it is to really be a screenwriter in the Hollywood system. I think personally, I kind of think, I used to think that if
a guy wrote a script. He would just turn it into somebody after maybe an elevator pitch got approved. And then that would just get made into a movie. But I have to understand that that's got to be naive, and there's got to be a lot more involved in it. And I know we see a lot of people coming in and writing on movies, and so I'd love to hear from a screenwriter what it is like to actually do that job in Hollywood.
Yeah, and I'm also curious, Max, because I've known a lot of people who are also screenwriters and do stuff like this. And digging into the different, you know, scripts that you've been able to sell and some of the stuff that was put on the blacklist, et cetera, you not only are, you know, like you said, working really hard all the time and being very prolific, but you're spreading it all out really well to a lot of different houses and kind of shows a little bit of business acumen there. So if you could do anything to share some light for our listeners.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think so many questions, and I'll try to take it. I don't know that I have the one answer for what it's like to be a screenwriter. It's many things. I think, you know, one of the things about any kind of collaborative, medium like this, and it's not unique, but it's fairly unique. It due to its scale, making a movie that. There's so many cooks in the kitchen on any given project. That goes for an independent film as well, but to a much lesser extent. And I've done, I've worked on things at various different scales, but certainly when you're talking about, a job like, Godzilla, a project like that, there's so much money involved to get it to happen, and therefore so many people involved. That it really is not the case of writing something in a bubble in a vacuum and then that's the movie. Even if you wanted that to be the case, there are moments in the bubble in the vacuum that are really kind of joyous, and it's never quite a vacuum. But I would say like the closest you come with that would be like if you have a collaborative writer and director kind of conceptualizing things together, and maybe a producer who's involved and collaborative as we did on this movie, then you have a situation where for a little while you get to sort of retreat away into your imagination and just invent stuff. Then it has to interface with the whole machinery of not only who's going to make it, but before that, what they can make, what they want to make.
How's it costed?
What's that?
Oh, how's it costed, et cetera.
Cost, but also, and then just everyone's opinion, and everyone has different thoughts and different feelings about what it, ought or ought not be. And, it's a very complicated, it's like any design process where there are that many people involved. It's very imperfect. It's not a science. It becomes kind of messy, and therefore I think it's a miracle whenever any movie gets made, really. I mean, people say that, and it's almost to the point where it's cliche, but it's absolutely true, and it's totally non-linear. I mean, the simplest process, the one that feels as simple as possible, where like one person is credited as a writer and there's one director, and it's never been through any craziness. It's been through craziness. And then most movies that you see, or every movie, there's an epic behind the making of it, because it's such a big undertaking. I mean, it's really every movie you're both literally and figuratively creating a new company to make it, in every sense, with employees and infrastructure and politics, and it's all unique to that movie, though people are bringing other baggage to it. And like a company that's producing this one product, there are different, stages of it and different conflicting needs and imperatives. And so it's just a very, and then you take that and you say, well, my job in it, as the writer, is kind of foundational, but then at the same time, going forward, it's to be sort of a shepherd. And as the script is, as the movie is coming together based on your script and new, like, you know, exigent circumstances are coming into play that have to do with, you never know, like budgetary or actors or whatever it may be. There's so many variables. Then your job as the screenwriter is to try to the extent that you're allowed to be involved in the process, which in this case, you know, gratefully I was, your job, I think, is to try to keep an eye on the story you're telling and wherever possible to sort of keep it directed in that way, you know? So sometimes, you know, scenes will get cut and characters will start to shift as a result of that. But you try, and the director, you know, this is their main job, is trying to steward that, you know, that ship and captain that ship. And your job, I think, is to be the person focusing on the story to the extent that you can, so that as all the moving pieces are happening, you're the one raising your hand saying, you know, yeah, but if we cut that, you know, be aware that, you know, we're going to lose this nuance. So maybe we need to do that, but maybe we can, you know, we can think about adding something else here if we're not going to do that, you know? So, that's a very long winded answer that's the functional work of it. As to what it's like to work in Hollywood, that's a totally different question.
Long-winded answers are completely welcome here, man. Totally.
Yeah. Yeah. What was the other part of your question? Remind me.
Oh, my second half. I have all these follow-up questions now, so I'm trying to focus. I was just kind of digging into the fact that, like, you know, you were in your long answer, which was awesome. You were going into some of the soft skill and sort of the alchemy and the balancing act that one has to do in a collaborative effort like this, right?
Yeah.
And one of the things I was talking about is sort of the more business acumen side of it. Like, you know, you have your representation, you have your different scripts, you have all these different houses and the different people at it. It's sort of like in LA, sometimes somebody has only an in with one place or only a bent ear someplace, but it seems like your scripts are, you know, the quality of them and the interest you're getting is coming from a lot of different houses. And so that being said, I was wondering if that's a strategy of yours business-wise, or is it just something that's you've been lucky to kind of come across?
I think it's a combination, and it's more of an organic thing. You know, it has to do with, you know, my interests are fairly eclectic. I think, you know, it's like the truth is had I, you know, I would never have thought that I would make a Godzilla movie just because it's not like, you know, I'm not a guy who is like a single-minded sort of like, you know, it's in any way. I mean, there's no one genre that's the only genre I would be interested in working in, but I had never thought of myself as like, you know, the biggest Godzilla fan. Growing up, I was interested in it almost because I didn't, you know, in high school, like, I mean, I've told this story elsewhere, but I had watched, you know, I had seen the Power Rangers and I didn't get it at all, like in middle school. But I thought it was weird and funny and kind of kitschy, and that interested me. But the movies I was watching at the time, like I was obsessed with Toho movies, but I was really obsessed with Kurosawa. That's the Toho movies that I watched, like all of them obsessively. And so then I was like, oh, what are these other movies? And oh, that's kind of like the derivation of all these man in suit things. And I got into that, but I didn't really know all of what Godzilla could be or really what it had been in its first, you know, incarnation, this very sort of dark, deliberative, grounded meditation on nuclear war. I had no idea until I was sort of approached about the possibility of you know, doing a new version by Legendary. And then I got really excited about that as a way in that, you know, from a personal standpoint, interested me. But I guess all of this is to say that, like, I kind of follow my whatever the passions are and whatever my interests are when it comes to those sorts of jobs in Hollywood. I mean, like, there's two things, you know, there's the things you develop on your own that are your, you know, little passion projects and your babies. And then there are things that are coming that other people have as properties that, you know, they may approach you with. And, you know, I try to only engage on ones that I can fall in love with in some way, you know, and be as excited about them as I would be about something that was self-generated. But because I have a fairly kind of eclectic taste, I'm not like the sci-fi guy or the thriller guy. I've really, you know, I've done a lot of different things, which is kind of, you know, makes it difficult when people are like, oh, well, what's the thing you do? And I'm like, well, I don't really know. That's a good question. I do things that I like. I don't know that anyone could really answer. I don't think that anyone who's like from the outside considered this kind of guy, I don't think they from the inside see themselves that way. Like, Stephen King, it'd be easy to call him like the horror guy, but he's not the horror guy. I mean, he writes thrillers and he writes other things, you know, and he's just a writer who follows his passions, you know, and I think that's the only way to do it authentically.
And you said you want to do some directing too, right?
Yeah, because you've done some shorts, correct?
Well, I actually have never made, well, I've made a couple like 48 hour shorts, but I've made a feature, which I directed, my senior year of college. I wrote and directed and shot and edited, and we had phenomenal, actors. I went to Yale, and there is just an amazing theater scene there. Not there at the time was not much of a film program. I didn't take film. But I exploited their theater department to get all these amazing actors, to work for free in the movie. And we made a feature film, a feature length film for $0. I mean, really, for about $1,500, all of which we got granted by the school, just as like a project budget, which I spent on, hard drives. Because it was all pre-HD, but it was digital. And I wish it wasn't pre-HD, because, you know, that's so much better. But still, you know, it came out, you know, really well considering, and we're all really proud of it. And so I wrote, you know, my intention was always to, you know, just continue doing exactly that. And I came out here to L.A., and I immediately had that in hand, and I wrote a script that wasn't, you know, that one had was all about people who were my age at the time and college and whatever, just being in relationships and shit like that. Oh, sorry. Stuff like that. And then, you know, after that, I wrote this other screenplay when I came out here, and, it was very quickly, I wrote it for myself to direct, but instead it was optioned, and Richard Gere came on to star in it. And so it kind of like kicked it out of my level for a moment to direct. And this other director, bigger director, came on. It never ended up happening, but it got me into the world of writing professionally. And I've been doing that ever since. I have something now that I'm putting together to direct again, which I'm looking forward to, but I also really love writing things that I, you know, that aren't necessarily the things that I would direct.
Mm-hmm. I'm kind of interested. Can you tell us anything as far as maybe themes or genre that you're aiming for the project you'd like to direct?
I it's a true story. I can't get into it too much, just for other reasons.
Of course.
But it's a true story. That's really it's in a weird way it involves healing. It's a redemption story that has to do with like emotional and physical healing in the wake of a disaster. And not dissimilar in certain thematic ways for some of the stuff, if you really really dig deep in Godzilla, that's there.
Yeah, the speaking of which, I mean, before we get too deep into the Godzilla stuff, there's so much family and redemption elements of that entire film. So on the second viewing, I was telling Kyle that really struck me.
The worst thing you can do as a screenwriter or anything, I think, is try to chase an idea that you know, was what you think people want.
Yeah,
you have to be writing something that you want, you know, and then that's what people want. You know, you have to tell people what they want by showing them something worthy, you know, and
worthy of wanting, like, correct?
You know, yeah. Material, but it goes for, you know, I think it goes for when you're tackling something that's, you know, an existing, you know, piece of intellectual property or whatever you want to call it, like Godzilla,
right?
Where you say, okay, like, there are certain, you know, you can read, and I did, you know, read, you know, fanboy blogs and stuff, and like what people's opinions were about, like, you know, just in a vacuum, what movies they would have made, you know, like what version of a Godzilla movie they would have liked to have seen way back when I was first sort of coming on to the project. And, you know, some were probably similar to what we did. A lot were probably different than what we did. And, you know, but what we had to do was say, you know, what's the movie that we're interested in seeing, you know, what's the one we can bring our heart and soul to, and then let's devote our energies to that. And then the really gratifying thing is when, you know, not everybody, but a lot of people come around and see it and say like, oh, that's the Godzilla movie I always wanted. Maybe I never knew it, but that's a great version, you know, or whatever. And that's it. That was, you know, that process is sometimes like made more difficult by the sort of extent to which, you know, everyone is very vocal and has an opinion on the internet about everything. And so yeah. You have to sort of engage in it to an extent, but also insulate yourself enough to be able to say, you know, what's the movie that we're making? What's the movie we believe in? And, you know, the most gratifying, or one of the most gratifying parts of the process was we knew like tonally what we wanted to do with this movie, but we also knew that that was something that no one was expecting off the bat, like coming out of the Roland Emmerich version, not to mention, you know, a general sense among the non Godzilla fans of something that could be campy or, you know, would be like really geared towards fan service as opposed to trying to be a little bit broader in its appeal. Like we knew what we wanted to do, but it was by no means something obvious to everybody. And we wanted to make a serious Godzilla movie. And I remember talking to people about that early on where they like looked at me like I was crazy. And then once, you know, Gareth made this teaser that we showed at Comic-Con that was really like the embodiment of the tone we were going for.
The one with the Oppenheimer quote?
The Oppenheimer thing, yeah, which was, it used to be like, awesome. The Oppenheimer thing was the sort of, that was like the epigram at the beginning of the script. And that whole thing was just very much like getting to see people see that and feel the reaction, which was, yeah, that's it. That's right. That was really heartening because it felt like we were just pursuing something that we thought was the version that we felt in our guts. And then to see people like react positively to that was really, you know, rewarding. But you can only, I think ultimately, you know, you really have to just follow your own barometer on that because, you know, that's all you've got.
Yeah. And that balancing act you spoke of, in production, you can really see that in the film because there's, anyone who's even going to attempt to try to make a Godzilla film, much less do what you and everyone else was able to do, which was basically reinvigorate and energize the brand for, you know, a whole new generation. It's balancing what you did in the film, like the family elements, the redemptive elements, the satisfaction of the more kind of pro wrestling or monster wrestling kind of stuff.
Right.
Yeah. It's this wonderful balancing act tonally. And, you know, every time I watch the movie successively, I would see more details in it that added more depth to it, that added more resonance to it. And it, everyone, you know, beautiful shots from the director and, you know, the director of photography, beautiful little touches in the script. Can you talk to us a little bit about some of the things that Kyle was getting to earlier, which is, you know, like sometimes people have this Barton Fink-esque kind of idea of like screenwriting, like, oh yeah, that's great, kid. And they like, you know, run away with the script. But you sound like you were involved a little bit more through the process, but like it's hard maybe for people to understand a through line from that fan moment or that wondrous moment of awe when you're thinking of something, captured in a, you know, the screenplay, then through all the different ways to finally see it executed. Are there any moments in the screenplay where you're like, I can see that moment from where it started as a seed and then see it come to life on the screen?
Yeah, well, I mean, so many, you know, I think, but to take it in a few parts, you know, I think that the, you know, one of the like it isn't the them taking the screenplay and running away and making a movie may like is not necessarily accurate, but in a lot of cases, I would say, or most cases with a movie of this scale, the writer doesn't get to be that involved throughout the whole process. That's a generality, but I would say that's pretty true. That usually, that's not the case, or at least it's fairly rare. And so I was kind of fortunate to be able to be involved from the inception of what became this version of the story. I mean, there had been a couple of pre-existing scripts that had been developed by Legendary prior to Gareth's involvement. And we really scrapped those and started from scratch when I came aboard. And, then at that moment, like the thing that felt resonant to me was trying to use Godzilla as a metaphor for our sense of powerlessness in a world that we feel like we're in control, you know, and it felt to me like the events of you know, the hurricane, the Katrina hurricane or the tsunami, that these things were sort of very vivid and present reminders of the fact that we may have the ability to order a Blu-ray DVD door-to-door, like same-day service.
Yeah,
Amazon San Francisco, yeah.
Right, but we could also be instantly washed away in San Francisco by a tsunami.
right.
Like, you know, I live in L.A. near Venice Beach, and we have, like, signs, tsunami warning signs, and you go, like, we go about our days as human beings completely you know, on an intellectual level, we're aware that it's a fragile world, but on a very deep level, we delude ourselves into believing that we're in control. And Godzilla feels like a great embodiment of that. And that felt to me like something that was really present right now. And I think that if you tap into, people might be able to say, like, oh, I get it. That's talking to me, even though it's a giant lizard, it's kind of speaking to a real world experience that we're all sort of familiar with and a real world feeling that we're familiar with. And so the initial concept that sort of spawned out of that was this idea of a disaster, what seemed like a natural disaster happening in Japan, that would lead this, you know, one generation of this family to become obsessed. And then, you know, history would be, you know, repeating itself years later, and that the next generation of that particular family would have to, in some way, hopefully have a better outcome to the same challenge. So that was sort of getting to see that just sort of become the movie, and getting, you know, from, cause that's, you know, the screenplay, like we did so much development on it and so much work on it over time. But getting to see that the through line, that when I look back to my very first notes for the conversation that I had, when I first came in to talk about it, that was the movie, you know?
So where were you, brought into the process? Cause I know that David Goyer and Frank Darabont were brought in at some point. I couldn't tell if that was pre or post Max Borenstein's involvement in the picture.
It's sort of a complicated question to answer, but Goyer was involved pre my involvement, and Darabont was involved post my involvement, but then his draft didn't work out and I was brought back.
I wanted to talk a little bit about the tone. You mentioned we were talking about the teaser with the Oppenheimer quote. And then I think that a lot of people went into this film thinking that Godzilla was going to be the you know, destroyer of worlds.
Right.
And I know that on a personal note, I was very shocked, actually, to see him turn into a heroic figure at the end of the movie. Not because that's not what I like in a Godzilla film, but I was just, everything that was leading up to the release of the film totally made me believe that it was going to just be really, really grim and dark. And it was really kind of cool to see Godzilla's tonal shift in the movie. And I was kind of wondering, was that something that you guys planned from the start, or was that an organic change that happened over the process of writing the script?
Oh, no, we always planned on the idea that Godzilla was, there would be other creatures, these two other creatures, and that Godzilla was sort of a balancing force that functionally a good guy, but not an anthropomorphic good guy in the sense that he's like...
Wait, he doesn't have a white hat on?
He's not like coming to save us. But he saves us because he's coming to do something else. And if you get out of his way, like, he doesn't really want to destroy us. He doesn't have any interest in us. And in the same way that, you know, you don't have, unless you're like a serial killer, you don't have any particular malice towards... rodents living in a field, but if they come into your, you know, in your house and start f***ing with your, or sorry, start, like, eating your breakfast, your cereal, then you're going to have to do something about it. And, Godzilla is coming to deal with an ancient threat to his own existential, being and his own existence. And, to the extent that we get in his way, he seems like a villain. But then the moment we realize that he's not out to get us, and if we get out of his way, we realize that he's actually this force of nature that's going to reestablish some balance that we might be able to coexist with.
Yeah, and that kind of beautifully dovetails with some of the thematic things that you were talking about earlier. And in the film, I just kept thinking, because there's that wonderful speech where he says, you know, man and nature, and, you know, as I brutally, you know, slaughter it. But basically, you know, that, you know, there's things that we don't have any control over. Let them fight, you know. And yes. In earlier on, he's like, he's basically a god. And I'm like, he is basically a god. Like, you know, he is Vigo. We are the buzzing of flies to him. Like, there's no...
Well, that's right. Yeah. I mean, it's like the god for all intents and purposes, because, you know, what is a god but something that is beyond our comprehension and control?
Yeah.
It may take many forms, and it's, you know, it could be, you know, in Godzilla's case, I mean, I think, you know, he is to us as we are to an ant.
Mm-hmm.
We don't notice, and we may step on, but if we notice one, we know it's an ant. We know it's something else other than us. We don't really understand what's going on in it. Yeah. It doesn't really understand what's going on in us. Presumably, if it had an intelligence, it could kind of try to gather what we're doing, but we're at such a different scale that it's impossible for us to communicate. Mm-hmm. But our actions can seem capricious and mm-hmm. godlike. But at the same time, if there's something kind of, I think, kind of nice about thinking of Godzilla that way, as being something that is this sort of larger force. And, you know, it brings it like a level of spirituality that feels like not quite hokey. You know?
No, I totally agree, because that's how I felt. I feel like there's a relaxing element when you feel small, like when people get upset about science over faith and you try to explain to people, well, I find it actually deeply calming to know that the universe is huge and cares not for my motivations, because it reminds me that I am not the center of the universe, you know?
That's right. Yeah. Well, and I think that very well articulates the theme of the movie from its, if there's a moral to the movie, I guess it has to do with that sense of, not being the center of the universe, that, you know, the arrogance of man, you know, is thinking that, that, you know, we're in control of nature and not the other way around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, that feels like something that we, you know, it's, but, you know, and I say it not in a preachy or moralizing mm-hmm. way, because, you
Giant
know, it's something
about
that,
the fight.
We all do all the time. I think it's very basic to what it means to be human is, you know, we make tools. We use our mm-hmm. minds to control the world around us. And that means that we, you know, are going to leave a swath of destruction in our wake. And as we get more and more advanced, that swath of destruction gets wider and wider. And the question is, at what point are we going to realize that we have to, that there is nothing that's going to stop us apart from our own, you know, self-regulation.
Mm-hmm.
And if we don't, then more of these disasters, you know, that are outside our control mm-hmm. are going to get worse and worse to the point where, you know, something, some force, just the balancing force of entropy or mm-hmm. chaos in the universe, whatever you want to call it, is going to even it out. Yeah. And in the movie, that's Godzilla.
Oh, yeah. And I was going to say, I think you have, from a world-building, you know, point of view, an interesting conundrum. It's the same one as a nerd you always feel with, like, Thor in the Marvel comics, which is, there's a god, and so you'd be kind of a little bit justified, like, to worship them. And so when I saw the movie, I kept thinking about it. I'm like, if, you know, in the sequel, people were sitting there going, like, you know, here's our Godzilla cult. Get out of its way.
Yeah, you can imagine that could happen.
Yeah, because it'd be like, yeah, I have proof of my god. He crushed San Francisco.
There will be the Branch Davidians and Godzilla or whatever.
Oh, Kyle,
actually, I have a. Do you asking that question spawned another question in my brain? So in Pacific Rim, Guillermo del Toro and the screenwriter for that movie, Travis Beecham, those guys created this, like, essentially a Bible that dealt with that universe, and they had a very rich fake. Reality going on there where Godzilla was set in our reality, essentially.
Travis is a genius at that, by the way. I've read, I mean, I know him fairly well, and he's amazing. Cool. And he's a genius at world invention in a way that few people are.
So did you guys have any sort of Bible or world, maybe not a Bible, but like, did you guys have some sort of mythos that you built up and documented in some form or another?
We did a lot of thinking about the about background and about sort of the scientific grounding of it. I think, you know, the big difference is that, you know, Travis and Guillermo are making a movie that's about, you know, where our movie happened, and then they're making the movie 25 years later or something like that. And so their Bible is all about what transpired in those 25 years, you know, so they're making like the 25th sequel.
Right. Yeah.
Movie, you know, and so what that means is, you know, for us, it wasn't so much about creating a Bible of an alternate universe, because what we wanted to do more than anything was to posit that this was happening in our universe.
Of course. Yeah.
So the things we thought about, weren't so much world building as, well, okay, like, scientifically, let's try to imagine a plausible, Godzilla. How does Godzilla exist? How does he survive? Where has he been? When did he come about? And then these other creatures, the Mudos, what are they? What's their relationship to Godzilla, naturally? And the real challenge there, we set ourselves, was trying to come up with other creatures that would feel organic to our version of what Godzilla was. So that rather than being like a completely new buy-in, like, you know, asteroid crashes to Earth and something pops out and then up comes Godzilla, we wanted that. We felt like that is asking the audience to sort of go really far, you know, because we're saying there's this lizard underneath the ocean, and now we're also saying another creature comes. So we wanted to make sure this other creature was something that was part and parcel of the same, block of marble, shall we say, that Godzilla is chiseled out of, so that they're from the same epoch and their life cycles are intertwined in some way, so that these are parasitic creatures that have in fact kind of summoned Godzilla up from his perspective as prey. From their perspective, also, he's their prey, and they're parasitic, and they're planning to use him as their mating vessel or whatever it may be. I think that was the kind of thinking that we did a lot of.
Well, that's a lovely segue into talking about the graphic novel Godzilla Awakening and the world building that you have done, talking about bringing a prequel into existence. Can you tell me a little bit about how you came about this story? Like, you and your cousin worked on it, right?
Yeah, me and my cousin. Well, so what happened was the Ken Watanabe character in the film was always one of my favorite characters, due to the way that, you know, movies happen, quite a few of his scenes ultimately fell by the wayside, many of which we shot, but it turned out it was just, you know, didn't quite fit lengthwise, and so those things were lost, and it was made for a better movie, but there was a part of me, and I think a part of Gareth too, that was sad to see them go, because there were aspects to his character that were very rich and interesting that we both, you know, gravitated towards, mm-hmm. and that Ken Watanabe had done such a beautiful job in portraying. And so in particular, there was one speech that he gave in the earlier drafts of the script where that was all about his father's pocket watch, and his father had lived through the bombing of Hiroshima, and he talked about it at length. It was like a long speech. We wanted to do that thing of having a really long speech in the movie, which was not about the plot at all. And it was a cool speech, I think. Ken, when he performed it, cried, and it was pretty great. And I'm hoping it winds up on the Blu-ray. We'll see. But regardless, that speech sort of was the genesis of me thinking about this character's backstory and, you know, who he was and where he came from, and when we started thinking about expanding this universe in a graphic novel and kind of telling some other tales from the universe and a kind of or sort of origin-ish story, he felt like the obvious place to go. And, you know, his father, because we had this idea of his father's watch, and there is a remnant of that in the movie where he, you know, he shows his father's watch to David Strathairn, and mm-hmm. But there were, you know, there was more of that, so that was sort of the jumping off point for the graphic novel.
Cool. Was it easy to move from screenwriting? Because I know there are some similarities between scripts for a movie and scripts for comic books. Was that language similar enough to you?
Well, I always referred to him as I couldn't help but like I the language was my worst part, because I was always like talking about scenes and like episodes, and it's like no, it's like, you know, panels and my cousin is, I mean I'm an appreciator and a reader of some graphic novels and some comic books, but I'm not a follower right now. And my cousin is very much a follower. Like, he keeps up on, you know, his favorite books and weekly, and he tips me off as to the stuff that I should check out, is basically how it goes. And so
like a good cousin should.
Yeah. Right. And so, and that's been happening, you know, for a while, actually. I mean, growing up, I was always more into movies. He was always into comic books. I'd read comic books at his house. And so recently we were kind of dabbling in this comic book that we'd kind of hatched on our own that we were writing, and are still writing. But then when this opportunity came up, and Legendary said that they were interested in doing and had the rights to do a Godzilla graphic novel that could like expand on the film's universe, then I just called Greg up and said, hey, you know, are you interested? And here's this sort of vague idea I have. And, you know, we were in New York. I was visiting New York for whatever reason, and we just took a walk around and kind of came up with this story, and then worked on that together. And so the learning curve was interesting. I mean, doing, you know, I think, you know, he, we'd already been starting to kind of learn the vernacular of it a little bit on this other project, but there's, you know, there's a lot to learn, and it's definitely, there's a lot more you can do. You know, the limitations are actually really interesting, you know, avenues for exploration. I mean, my favorite page in the comic book, and the thing I'm kind of most proud of in the book is, there's this one page, and weirdly, it had two forms. There was an earlier version of it, drawing wise, that was like, that was exactly what we had written. And then the version in the book, the artist took like a few liberties, and I actually think it works better. But, it's this page where it kind of tells the sort of history of the world as it revolved around Godzilla. Godzilla was there unbeknownst to us.
Yeah.
And kind of comes into being and invents, you know, the wheel and roads and cars and eventually a city, and then and then the bomb drops on the city, and then Godzilla wakes up. And it just felt like this really cool, elegant way of like lapsing through time.
Yeah,
that you just couldn't do in a movie in quite the same way. I mean, in a movie it would take minutes to do that, and the closest thing you could come to would be this sort of Darren Aronofsky and Noah, you know, kind of thing, which is awesome, you know, or the Terrence Malick kind of scenes of like interesting, trippy kind of time lapse stuff. But in this, it's just this one page, and it's so simple and clean.
Yeah, it's a really beautiful page, and it's got a kind of planetary vibe if you're familiar with that comic.
Yeah, I love Warren Ellis.
Yeah,
and it's funny that you mentioned that particular page, because that is the one that when I was reading through the comic, that one made me stop, put it down, and look up the artist Eric Battle on the internet and see if he had a place where he was selling the original art from that.
It's so funny you should say that. That's the page that Greg and I, in fact, Greg and I want that page, and we were promised that page, and I've yet to see it, but I was told that like.
Well, then you hear it first on Kaiju Cast. We're calling him out.
Yeah. Well, yeah, Mr. Battle.
I'm looking forward to that, because that was, yeah, that page is fantastic.
That's awesome, man.
Let the bidding war begin.
Yeah. I think you'd outbid me in a heartbeat, though. So, what do you have any sort of final thoughts on making Godzilla? I mean, I could ask you a million questions, and we do have a couple more questions from some of our supporters. Really quick questions, but do you have anything like that you took away from Godzilla as being there basically from start to finish and seeing the final product?
I'll say it as you know, we've spoken a lot about Godzilla, so like I'll just say it as, you know, what I, not about Godzilla specifically as a cultural phenomenon, because I've talked about that at length, but I would say in terms of like the process of being able to see something from start to finish and live with it and let it take on a life of its own while trying to kind of parent it. It's a wild process. And, you know, I think if you come out the other end of something like that with nothing but a movie, you're lucky, you know, and if you come out with a movie that you actually are proud of and like, and feel, you know, pleased to have your name on, then it's a blessing. And that's how I feel about this movie, because, you know, it's so, there's so many challenges and obstacles along the way of making anything, even like a short film that, you know, I'm sure many of your listeners have made, you know, those are all so difficult. Any project, not any creative project, even one that relies on nothing but yourself, and your own tools, but then especially exacerbated when it's a project that relies upon other people and their involvement and collaboration and people working in this kind of cohesive way. That's so difficult. And there's so many moving pieces and so many variables that could set it off the rails, that to come out with anything even coherent at the end is a miracle. And then to come out with something that you actually like is a blessing. And so I feel really, really thrilled and proud and happy that, that's happened. And, you know, if anything, it makes me look at other creative enterprises differently. You know, I watch movies and I watch, and I read, you know, graphic novels very differently than I did purely as a fan. Because now I look at it and I realize what a undertaking it is and how crazy it is that anything comes into being. That, like, human beings who are so fractious and contentious, and that we're all our own individual minds, can ever collaborate on anything and produce something that's of a piece is you know, more than a small miracle.
Very cool, man. Like I said, I got a couple of small questions here just from the listeners. Mike wanted to know if you could maybe describe the scenes of, I don't know if you're familiar with him, but Akira Takarada. He was the Japanese actor who was cut from the...
Yeah, I had the pleasure of meeting him because I was there the day his scene was shot.
Could you describe the stuff that was cut from the film?
I think it's going to be on the Blu-ray, so I don't know if I should kind of, if it's cool to give it away. He had a cool cameo when the character arrives, when Ford arrives in Japan. There used to be an airport scene, and Takarada-san was the person who was like the customs man who like welcomed him, and they had, you know, he had a nice moment with our hero kind of arriving in Japan.
Very cool.
That we wrote for him. Ultimately the scene itself was sort of had to go away for structural reasons in the movie. Really, you know, it was a shame. Everyone was really kind of bummed that it happened, but
at least we get it on the Blu-ray.
It'll be on the Blu-ray,
totally.
And we certainly, you know, want him back if he's able to, if there's a sequel, and, you know.
Very nice. And then Benjamin wanted to know, aesthetically and or thematically, what is your favorite depiction of Godzilla as a character?
That's a good question. As a character, I'm not going to take too much from that. To me, my favorite Godzilla film is the first. It's the one that's got the most rich, sort of like ethos around it. And it speaks so deeply to this moment in history that it actually feels ever present and it doesn't date. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's what's kind of remarkable about it. I mean, any movie you watch, even from 5 years ago, is bound to feel dated. And when you see a movie that's 60 years old, and that even the effects, by the way, are pretty damn good. But like, apart from the occasional, very occasional in that film, like scenes that feel a little bit cheesy, which is not so bad because that's kind of a go-to in the genre anyway, but very little. You watch that movie and it feels very, very present and fraught. The melodrama stuff is not that bad, mm-hmm. but the rest of it, but that's kind of a small part of it. The rest of it is amazing. And you see the scenes, the intensity of the people, the victims of Godzilla's arrival, like that is just terrifying and present in a way that I, you know, makes that movie my favorite Godzilla movie. And I think, you know, Godzilla in it, interestingly, it's weird to talk about him as a character in that film, because he is a character, but not in the sense that we usually mean it. I mean, he's really an actual disaster in that film.
Right, right.
And our challenge or our goal with the movie was to honor that version of Godzilla, but add this element that he's an animal and that he has his own motivations, and that once we kind of transition the film into sort of seeing the world through his eyes, then suddenly like our allegiance shifts, and that moment where he and Ford are both kind of down for the count, I always see as this sort of passing of the baton moment between
totally,
them.
Totally.
And that's this moment where our allegiance as the audience is now fully with Godzilla, and we realize that our fate is in his hands, and that he is a character in a way. I don't know if I answered the question.
I think you answered it very well. Okay, so the last question from Tom is a little bit more involved as far as the question goes, but he says, how much do you, as the writer, take the actual science involved in the film into account, and how much would you like to versus the needs of production or the plot trumping the desire for scientific accuracy?
You know, I think it's, well, it's always, I try to take it seriously, and early on I take it very seriously, and then, you know, things are always going to come up that are going to, you know, force you to compromise scientifically. Now, like, there's one, you know, there's one gigantic compromise, which is that this could never happen.
So, no,
you know, I think
I don't want to believe that.
But I think so. What you do is you go within that. Let's try to be as you know coherent as we can and play by our own rules. And you know, in a movie like this, there is always going to be it's a balance, because if you're too focused on making the science accurate, then you can have no fun and you have no movie. Indeed, you have no movie, because, you know, the law of whatever the, you know, what do they call that? You know, squared rule of mass, where it's like, Godzilla couldn't exist physically, size-wise.
Are you talking about square inverse?
Yeah.
Exactly.
That ruins so many childhoods. That's worse than finding out that there's no, like, Santa Claus and stuff like that.
So that's
my mom walked in and told me that, and I was like, game over.
I went to the San Diego Zoo early on in the process. They convened – they, like, basically gave half of their board – they have this, like, meeting every week of, like, the heads of all the different departments. So, like, the – you know, the bird people, the cat people, the simian people, etc. Mm-hmm. And we had they kind of gave half that meeting to me and gave their time to say, well, answer these questions of, well, okay, Godzilla can't exist, the Mudos can't exist, but if they existed, then what?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they were great. I mean, they had they had a really good time. I had a great time. And they told me, you know, we worked it out and thought it through to the extent that, you know, I had a working idea of how this could happen, and I had answers, and everything is logical within the universe, you know, and then, you know, and that's the best you can do. And then, you know, you aim for as few holes as you can, but there are always going to be some.
Right on, man. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us. I really, really appreciate you making that connection, and thanks to Tom as well, by the way. And congratulations on the hit that is Godzilla. I'm super pleased, as a massive Godzilla fan myself. I am very pleased that it's doing so well in the theaters, both domestically and internationally.
Wonderful. Well, I'm so thrilled you are, and it's been really fun talking to you guys, thanks for having me.
Do you have anything else you want to promote or anything else coming up that you need to share with the listeners?
I have nothing that I'm allowed to talk about, but things that I think the listeners would be excited about, that a couple things that I'm working on at Legendary that I think if you're a fan of Godzilla, you will be excited about. And I can say no more under penalty of worse than death, but soon... soon, hopefully, that will become those will get their kind of official announcements, and I think people will be excited.
Excellent. Well, thank you again, sir. I really appreciate it.
Cool. Well, thanks, guys.
Man, Max Borenstein was like super cool. It was a lot of fun to talk to him. Once again, big thanks to Max. Big thanks to Tom for even making that happen. And hopefully, you guys enjoyed it. And hopefully, you will understand that this media blitz must continue, and therefore we are not going to do the news in this episode. But there is one last thing. I wanted to remind you that you need to have your Daikaiju discussion homework turned in by July 25th if you want to be included in the episode for Gamera versus Gauss, which we will be recording next week. And like I said, make sure you get that in before the 25th. So we are going to close the show out with one final track, and it's been a while, I think, since we've played Michiro Oshima on the show, so we are going to play Mazer All Out Attack, and this is from Tokyo SOS. We will see you for the next... Actually, we'll see you next week for the next episode. Until then, Jamata.